Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side two of For the Record program number 425, titled Closing the Ring, update on September 11th, being recorded on September 22nd of 2003. WFMU archiving the For the Record shows, recent shows streaming at wfmu.org/Dave Emery, older shows at a longer URL for download only, Spitfire website, spitfirelist.com, descriptions of the shows, annotated descriptions of the shows, and also the latest pair of For the Record section, programs, I should say, on Real Audio. And be aware that I do not make money from the Spitfire arrangement. Okay, all righty. Back to the book Terrorist Hunter, authored by, quote, Anonymous, a very real woman, someone who's known to people, familiar with the Green Quest raids, about the story of the Green Quest raids, which basically connected the milieu of al-Taqwa and the Muslim Brotherhood, a milieu that goes to the Underground Reich, as I call it, with the Republican Ethnic Outreach Organization. Turning once again to 555 Grove Street and the SAR network. No wonder they didn't publicize SAR. No wonder they saw no need to raise money from donations. They alone could continue to fund worldwide terrorism for the next millennium. I'd finally breached 555's wall of deception. First battle won, but I was still far from winning the war. A certain issue about SAR bothered me for some time. SAR, after I discovered what it was, I began calling everything at 555, the SAR network, was a multi-bill, by the way, again, 555 is 555 Grove Street in Herndon, Virginia. Beginning again, a certain issue about SAR bothered me for some time. SAR, after I discovered what it was, I began calling everything at 555 Grove Street, the SAR network, was a multi-billion dollar organization operation that was tightly linked to the IIIT and to some 100 other organizations. IIIT was involved with the Palestine Islamic Jihad, Hamas, and the Muslim Brotherhood. Farhan, Sami al-Aryan, Shalah, and Nafi were linked to it. The Saudi billionaires, al-Rajis, were funneling money to terrorist organizations through their fronts. These terrorist organizations were Palestinian, a notion that agreed with the Muslim Brotherhood ideology. But it seemed unreasonable that all this monstrous mechanism had been created only with the Middle East in mind. By the way, I would note in passing that Sami al-Aryan, the investigation of whom helped to precipitate much of the Operation Green Quest raids, has most unfortunately been hailed as a political prisoner and a martyr, and although there has yet to be a legal finding in his case, the available evidence suggests that he is anything. But in particular, he's been lionized as a victim and a political martyr on the Pacifica Radio Network, of all things. And that's rather ironic because that places the Pacifica Radio Network, basically, or at least considerable elements who hold forth on it, in the same milieu as not only Operation Green Quest raids, but the Underground Reich, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Bush administration and the GOP. Fancy that. Continuing. The Saudi billionaires al-Rajis were funneling money to terrorist organizations through their fronts. These terrorist organizations were Palestinian, a notion that agreed with the Muslim Brotherhood ideology, but it seemed unreasonable that all this monstrous mechanism had been created only with the Middle East in mind. A year after I'd figured out the connection between 555 and al-Raji, the embassy bombings trial began, during which the government released previously classified documents about the investigation. One such document was Wadi al-Hajj's phone book, the same book in which Ghassan Daduli's numbers had been found. I went through both books, parts of which are in Arabic and others in English. Some portions were hardly legible. Toward the end of the book, I saw the name with an address in Saudi Arabia. The name? Saleh Abdul Aziz al-Raji, SAR. Now, by the way, Wadi al-Hajj is Osama bin Laden's personal secretary. Now, why would Osama bin Laden's personal secretary have the contact information for Saleh al-Raji? A few days later, the government released al-Hajj's other phone book, Again, Saleh al-Raji's name appeared in it, this time not with an address but with a telephone number in Saudi Arabia. During his testimony in that trial, al-Haj disclosed how he started his way with bin Laden by joining the Afghan Mujahideen as a relief worker with the Saudi organization Muslim World League, or MWL. I knew that many other al-Qaeda members, such as Wael Juledan and Ihab Ali, began their jihad with MWL as well. After I'd heard that al-Haj was also involved with MWL, I checked for the address of its United States office. Naturally, it was 555 Grove Street. On the 20th day of the trial, the prosecutor discussed an al-Qaeda cell in the United Kingdom and mentioned a name that sounded awfully familiar to me, Tariq Hamdi. I looked in my ICP binder, and there he was. The last I'd encountered his name, Hamdi was nothing but Sami al-Aryan's secretary. How far he'd gone since then, I thought. Now he was traveling the world and personally delivering satellite phone batteries to bin Laden. So I studied the distinguished Mr. Hamdi further. Again, Mr. Hamdi graduated from being Sami al-Aryan's personal secretary to working for bin Laden. Continuing, of Mr. Hamdi, the former secretary to Sami al-Aryan, I soon found out that he, too, worked for the International Institute of Islamic Thought. And he listed his address as 555 Grove Street, Herndon, Virginia. Baterji, and that, by the way, is another key Saudi here discussed in past programs. Baterji's book, which in my view is bin Laden's biography, revealed to me some amazing facts about the al-Qaeda members who were closest to bin Laden. But that wasn't all I learned from it. On its back cover was the Benevolence International Foundation's logo and an inscription reading, Lajnat al-Bir al-Islamia, the Islamic Benevolence Foundation, and under that, the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, WAMY. I knew what WAMY was, but I didn't know anything about Lajnat al-Bir al-Islamia besides the fact that its name was similar to BIF's Arabic name. I searched in old Arabic publications and found a resume of one Ibrahim Hussein Bahavzala, stating that he headed the charity Lajnat al-Bir al-Islamia. Naturally, I looked for possible Bahavzala links in America. I found that he was the vice president of MWL and two other organizations, all claiming 555 Grove Street as their address. So there was a strong link between the publishers of the book and 555 Grove Street, but there was more. On the inside jacket, it said that the book was published in 1991 in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia, by Al-Watania Publishing Company. Al-Watania, the same Watania I had found in 555's trash, belonged to al-Raji. Its subsidiaries in the United States were Marjak Poultry and the other companies listed at 555 Grove Street. There was no doubt left in my mind. The SAR network was tied not only to Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, but also to al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda became a part of the 555 Grove Street story. Or, in other words, any investigation of mine, be it PIJ, Hamas, or al-Qaeda, turned out to be somehow associated with that address. Risking a cliché, I found that all roads of terrorist funding and ideology in America led to 555 Grove Street. At that point in my investigation, two critical questions remained unresolved about the SAR network. One was, how did the men heading the SAR network, none of whom were Saudi, end up controlling a multi-billion dollar Saudi-funded empire? Many of the directors of the SAR network live in a fancy neighborhood of Herndon, Virginia, on a street and a court named Safa. Their group is now believed by the government to be a close-knit and secretive organization. That, by the way, is the Safa Trust. Anyway, one of the organizations is the Safa Trust. Continuing, I found the answer to that in IIT's corporate records. The records stated the following names of founders and board members: Taha Jaber al-Alwani, World Assembly of Muslim Youth, Saudi Arabia; Jamal Barzinji, World Assembly of Muslim Youth, Saudi Arabia. Not mentioned here, by the way, is the fact that Jamal Barzinji was a director of the Islamic Institute of Grover Norquist, tied in, as we'll see later, to the Al-Taqwa Network, and obviously through that to the Republican Party, among other institutions. Again, Taha Jaber al-Awani, World Assembly of Muslim Youth, Saudi Arabia. Jamal Barzinji, World Assembly of Muslim Youth, Saudi Arabia. Oh my God, I thought IIIT was but a different name for WAMY. WAMY, the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, was for youth. IIIT was WAMY for the youth who came of age. Baterji, who has been named Bin Laden's financier by the government, headed World Assembly of Muslim Youth in the early 1990s. World Assembly of Muslim Youth published Baterji's biography of Bin Laden, where the river of jihad, unquote, is glorified. WAMY published manuals found in the possession of Ahmed Ajaj, one of the conspirators in the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, where the hijacking of buses and murder of civilians were glorified, and where poisonous hate statements were made against Americans, Christians, and Jews. WAMY's director in the United States since the day it was founded was Abdullah bin Laden, Usama's half-brother. For these reasons and others, the FBI considers WAMY a suspected terrorist organization. Above all, WAMY was a Saudi organization, a fact over which it took great pride. It even received funding from the government of Saudi Arabia. Barzinji, Al-Alwani, Al-Talib, and Ahmed Tatonji, the four Iraqis who in time would establish the Saar Empire, somehow found their way to Saudi Arabia. The Saudi environment was perfectly conducive to their message and provided them with ample resources with which to promote their views. It was in Saudi Arabia that IIT was created, and whatever ideas led its founders to do so had to have ripened during their stay there. Something must have taken place in Saudi Arabia, I thought, that put them on a track leading to Saar. The most important question and the most difficult: what was the motive behind creating this gigantic empire in the West? It couldn't have been the funding of jihad only. It was far too big and too complex to serve just that. It had to have yet another purpose. To understand the motives, to find out what future these four Iraqis had envisioned, I decided to study their pasts. A chilling picture emerged. Ahmed Tatonji is one of the four Iraqis who were the heart and soul of the Saar network. Following the tradition I described, Tatonji went to England for his higher education, as did many affluent Iraqi men, including my older brother Ron. While studying petroleum engineering in 1960 in the United Kingdom, Tatonji established the Muslim Student Society of the United Kingdom together with other students, most of whom were Iraqis like him. During those years, he met his mentor, Hisham al-Talib, whose sister Tatonji married. Al-Talib was a close friend of Jamal Barzinji's, and both of them were heavily exposed to the Ali Khwan movement, the Muslim Brotherhood. And still more here about Al-Taqwa and the Saar Network here and the Muslim Brotherhood. Bear in mind that the Al-Taqwa Network links the Muslim Brotherhood with what I call the Underground Reich and with elements of the Republican Party. And again, some of the Al-Taqwa-linked, Muslim Brotherhood-linked, Green Quest-linked organizations have actually been lionized and portrayed as political victims by elements of the progressive political sector as well, which is as remarkable, I guess, as it is grotesque. Of the role of Youssef Nada, former German intelligence agent, Muslim Brotherhood member in the founding of the Saar Network, which in turn overlaps the Republican Party and the Bush administration. In 1976, the aforementioned Hisham al-Talib, Muhammad M. Shama, and Jamal Barzinji, parenthetically, of Grover Norquist's Islamic Institute, the founders of the Saar Network, founded a bank in the small kingdom of Liechtenstein in the city of Vaduz. They named it Nada International after its director, Youssef M. Nada. Nada, an Egyptian-born, naturalized Italian citizen in his 70s, a good friend of Iraq's Saddam Hussein, was one of the most prominent leaders of the Muslim Brotherhood. He was imprisoned in Egypt for his involvement in an attempt to assassinate Gamal Abdel Nasser, the first Egyptian president. After he was set free, he left for Europe, where he established the Muslim Brotherhood's major financial organizations and those of Al-Qaeda. Nada also became director of two banks founded in the Bahamas, Bank Al-Taqwa, or Fear of Allah, and Aqeedah Bank Private. On November 7, 2001, President Bush designated Bank Al-Taqwa, its key executives, and its closely affiliated businesses as financial supporters of Al-Qaeda and called to freeze Al-Taqwa's assets. Aqeedah was designated alongside Al-Taqwa. These two banks were later shut down by Bahamian authorities. The president described Al-Taqwa as, quote, an association of offshore banks and financial management firms that have helped Al-Qaeda shift money around the world. Al-Taqwa raises funds for Al-Qaeda. They manage, invest, and distribute those funds as well. They provide terrorist supporters with internet service, secure telephone communications, and other ways of sending messages and sharing information. They even arrange for the shipment of weapons. They present themselves as legitimate businesses, but they skim money from every transaction for the benefit of terrorist organizations. They enable the proceeds of crime in one country to be transferred to pay for terrorist acts in another. The president concluded by saying that by shutting these Al-Taqwa networks down, we disrupt the murderer's work. Today's action interrupts Al-Qaeda's communications. It blocks an important source of funds, unquote. As the Treasury described them, Al-Taqwa and Aqeedah were, quote, shell companies, unquote, and not functional banking institutions, unquote. Al-Taqwa, a network of companies in Switzerland, Liechtenstein, the Bahamas, and Italy, provided investment advice and cash transfer mechanisms for various radical Islamic groups. Al-Taqwa controlled at a certain point $220 million in assets. It had thousands of client investments in accordance with the Sharia Islamic law, which forbids charging interest. Among its largest clients were Youssef al-Qaradawi, his wife, his children, and many other members of his family. Other clients of Al-Taqwa included several members of the bin Laden family, including brothers and sisters of Usama. As Aqeedah Bank's director, Nada rather amazingly employed one Suleiman Abdul Aziz al-Raji, one of the Saudi brothers behind Saar. So al-Raji, with his legendary riches, worked for Nada. Yet Nada worked for Barzinji and al-Talib, who in turn worked for al-Raji's charity, the Saar Foundation. Are you good and confused? That is the general idea. And again, in passing, I've described this network in the past as an Islamo-fascist Enron. It uses the same sorts of offshore tax havens for exactly those kinds of nefarious purposes. Now, as mentioned, in the investigation of Jamal Barzinji, Abdullah bin Laden, the al-Rajis, and the Saar Foundation, one not only comes across the very powerful Saudi political and business allies of George W. Bush, among others, but also the milieu of the underground Reich and al-Qaeda. However, because of the sensitive political connections, including direct connections to the milieu of Karl Rove and George Bush and Grover Norquist, the Green Quest investigations generate a lot of flack and a lot of sensitivity, and the people, the customs agents, and the author of this book, and John Loftus, among others, all of the people investigating the Saar network then came under investigation and surveillance by not only the FBI, but the CIA. Turning once again to Terrorist Hunter, the CIA was investigating me and the Saar investigators from both Green Quest and Customs. The CIA and the FBI investigated everyone who had anything to do with the Saar investigation. White vans and SUVs with dark windows appeared near all the homes of the Saar investigators. All agents, some of whom were very experienced with surveillance, knew they were being followed. So was I. I felt that I was being followed everywhere and watched, at home, in the supermarket, on the way to work, and for what? While undercover, I needed to watch out during the conference, the prayer, the rally, but I could relax as soon as I was out of there. Now, I was being watched 24/7 by the FBI and CIA. It's a terrible sensation to know that you have no privacy and no security. That strange clicking of the phones that wasn't there before. The oh-so-crudely opened mail at home and in the office, and the same man I spied in my neighborhood supermarket who was also on the train I took to Washington a week ago. Life can be miserable when you know that someone's always breathing down your neck. The customs agents were questioned, so were their supervisors. So was the U.S. attorney on the Saar case. One of the questions they were all asked was whether they had leaked material to me. They all kept saying that this was the most preposterous idea. They all said that before I came, none of them had the slightest clue about Saar and 555 Grove Street. They said there was nothing of value that they could give me that I didn't have already. That it was I who gave them the material, not the other way around. None of the investigated parties had the slightest clue as to the real reason they were being investigated. Risking criticism for being unfoundedly paranoid, I must convey my theory about the investigation and the CIA's involvement in it. I don't know for certain what's the deal with the CIA investigating the Saar investigators, but it sure feels as if someone up in that agency doesn't like the idea that the Saudi Arabian boat is rocked. The raids on 555 Grove Street had already taken place. The CIA couldn't change that, but investigating and giving the people behind the raids a hard time is a most efficient way of making sure the Saar investigation stops right there. Which, come to think of it, may be the reason the government looks so unfavorably on the lawsuit filed by 9/11 victims' families against several Saudi entities and individuals, accusing them of funding terrorism and seeking damages. And turning from Terrorist Hunter to an article in Vanity Fair magazine of October of 2003, this is a description, this text excerpt is in the description for the record 423, talking again about Abdullah bin Laden, who was spirited out of the United States right after September 11th. In fact, the FBI had been keeping an eye on some of the bin Ladens. By the way, this article is called Saving the Saudis by Craig Unger. A classified FBI file examined by Vanity Fair and marked secret shows that as early as 1996, the Bureau had spent nearly 9 months investigating Abdullah and Omar bin Laden, who were involved with the American branch of the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, or WAMY, a charity that has published writings by Islamic scholar Saeed Qutb, one of Osama bin Laden's intellectual influences. But according to Dale Watson, the FBI's former head of counterterrorism, such investigations into Saudis in the United States were the exception. If allegations came up, they were looked into, he says, but a blanket investigation into Saudis here did not take place. Did a simple disclaimer from the bin Laden family mean that no one in the entire family had any contacts or useful information whatsoever? Not long after 9/11, Carmen bin Laden, an estranged sister-in-law of Osama's, told ABC News that she thought that members of the family might have given money to Osama. Osama's brother-in-law, Mohammed Jamal Khalifa, was widely reported to be an important figure in al-Qaeda and was accused of having ties to the 1993 World Trade Center bombing, to the October 2000 bombing of the USS Cole, and to the funding of a Philippine terrorist group as well. Khalifa was rumored to be in the Philippines in September of 2001. Khalil bin Laden, who boarded a plane in Orlando that eventually took him back to Saudi Arabia, won the attention of Brazilian investigators for possible terrorist connections, and according to a Brazilian paper, he had business connections in the Brazilian province of Minas Gerais, not far from the tri-border region, an alleged center for training terrorists. Then, there were the secret FBI documents detailing Abdullah and Omar bin Laden's involvement with the World Assembly of Muslim Youth, or WAMY. Indian officials and the Philippine military have both cited WAMY for funding terrorism in Kashmir and the Philippines. Quote, WAMY was involved in terrorist support activity, says a security official who has served under George W. Bush. There's no doubt about it. FBI officials declined to comment on the investigation, which was reported in Britain's The Guardian, but the documents show that the file on Abdullah and Omar was reopened on September 19, 2001, while the Saudi repatriation was still underway. These documents show that there was an open FBI investigation at these guys at the time, into these guys at the time of their departure, says David Armstrong, an investigator for the Public Education Center, the Washington, D.C. Foundation that obtained the documents. So very, very interesting that the aforementioned Abdullah bin Laden was spirited out of the United States. One of the things that I've noted in past broadcasts is that among the entities that operated out of 555 Grove Street was the GSISS, the Graduate School of Islamic Social Studies, which officially certifies Muslim chaplains for the U.S. military. And I've noted the possibility of an Islamo-fascist fifth column within the U.S. military. And one of the things that I'm going to put in the description, we're not going to have time to put it in the main body of the broadcast, is the allegation that a Muslim chaplain who operated out of Fort Lewis, Washington, which is where John Allen Muhammad, the accused D.C. sniper, was out of, was allegedly helping some of the Al-Qaeda detainees at Camp X-Ray. And we're going to talk about some of the links to John Allen Muhammad and the mysterious funding that he seems to have received while in a homeless shelter in Bellingham, Washington, the business center for the operations of Yaqub Mirza, one of the top 555 Grove Street Operation Green Quest targets. We're going to conclude with a very important article titled in Danny Pearl book, Levy, that's Bernard-Henri Levy, says next 9/11 brewing in Pakistan. This is from the New York Observer of September 15th of 2003. It's by Ron Rosenbaum. And talking about Omar Sheikh, the fellow who apparently kidnapped and executed Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter, Mr. Levy captures this divide in his book when he reports that Omar played chess and read Mein Kampf. At one point during the C-SPAN interview, I asked him about Omar and Mein Kampf. Quote, there are those who say Hitler is dead, unquote, but among people like Omar, terrorists, jihadists like him, Hitler is spoken of with affection, right? True, Mr. Levy said. According to the testimony of one of the men he kidnapped in India, Omar, quote, was able to recite entire pages of Mein Kampf by heart, unquote. Mr. Levy gave a world-weary Gallic shrug. Everybody has the poetry he deserves, unquote. And he went on to add that Omar was not alone in seeking to finish what Hitler started. You have today in Damascus, in Syria, in Libya, some people who think that the anti-Semitic message of the Nazis was a good message and has to be completed. Despite this, Mr. Levy maintains that Daniel Pearl was not killed as a Jew, but as a journalist who knew too much. And crucial to this account is what Mr. Levy describes as a change in plan in the midst of Pearl's captivity. And one of the things that Mr. Levy maintains is that he had learned about elements in the Pakistani national security establishment who were sympathetic to Mr. Omar and the concept of an Islamic bomb. Skipping down, prompted by the arrest of the British-born alleged shoe bomber Richard Reid, Pearl and his wife Marianne began to set up housekeeping in Karachi, where he begins to seek out a shadowy figure known as Sheikh Gilani, who has been described as Richard Reid's spiritual advisor. And skipping down, through a series of intermediaries, he finds himself meeting in a shady place called the Hotel Akbar in Rawalpindi with Omar, the jihadist who has links to many of the radical Islamist forces in Pakistani intelligence, who are seeking to undermine the fragile Musharraf government to end Pakistan's alliance with the U.S. in favor of a pro-Al-Qaeda Islamist foreign policy, and most of all, to place control of Pakistan's nuclear weapons, the so-called Islamic bomb, at the disposal of the worldwide Islamic crusade against the infidels of the West. And no doubt Mein Kampf would be an interesting addendum to that particular agenda. That concludes side two of For the Record program number 425, Closing the Ring, update on September 11th, being recorded on September 22nd of 2003. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.